The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Oh yeah, I'm already behind. Okay. That's okay. It's a delight to be with you all in person. I'm sorry I can't see all of you from my position. Paul, would you mind moving back just a tad so I can see Sage? Great. Well, okay, more than a tad. That works too. Yeah, good. So I don't do well talking with the mask, so bear with me. And the sound, is it a little bouncy? Okay. Sounds a little bouncy to me on this side. It's okay, good. Great. So. I'm going to offer you a little context and roadmap for the work of chaplains, and then in particular Buddhist chaplains. You may have watched the video already on the course website where people are asked, what's a chaplain? Anybody watch that video? People are like, what? What? Who? Charlie Chaplin? What? And you may have that question yourself. I may have that question. The really short answer is it's a minister who cares for people in a crisis when they are displaced from their usual place of living. So historically, chaplains, the word relates to the word chapel, and chapels were extensions of the church in rural areas. So where there wasn't a church or a cathedral, the Pope or the King had chapels, so kind of to make sure you got to everybody. Instead of the Pony Express, they had chapels out and about as the most important thing to make sure, no matter where people were. And I like to think about chaplaincy as service to people who are in crisis. Now, you can define crisis in a lot of ways. You could go with the crisis of human existence, existential crisis of what am I here for, you know, or the crisis of I'm in college, I'm in the military, I'm in the ER, I'm living on the streets, a loved one died, I'm incarcerated, I'm new to a sangha and a congregation, I'm a member and I'm in a crisis. Yeah, so I just always kind of keep that word in my head. So that's a really short, so if you get in an elevator and somebody wants to know, that's the, you can tailor that yourself, you know. And you will, over the course of this year, figure out what that means to you and how to articulate it. And you may or may not relate to the word chaplain. I relate to it. I am accustomed to people not knowing completely what it means, and I invite you to figure, see what happens. Yeah, there are a couple of national chaplain organizations in this country. There's a national education for ministers where they kind of place people in crisis settings and have a kind of a standardized curriculum. So those groups have like their definitions, their standards or doctrine. They talk about competencies for chaplains, like what are chaplains able to do? Yeah. And also they talk about in educational dimensions, what are the learning outcomes? So like for us here, one way to think about what Paul and Gil put in practice language, if I was to put that in education language, you know, there are certain learning outcomes that we're headed towards in this training, and the curriculum is designed accordingly. And our pedagogy, our methodology, has several aspects to it. One is it's contemplative. And two is it's based on experiential learning and adult learning theory. Yeah. What really works, I think, at the heart of it is the experiential learning, where, as Paul was relating, you do something, you reflect on it, think about it, feel it, let it settle, whatever word you want to use, and then you do it again. And when you do it again, you're informed by the last time you did it as well as the reflection. So some of the learning comes from just doing it. Like, oh, I did this once, I'm going to do it again, so now I know what it feels like to hop on one foot up a step, you know. But the integration is more like, what was that like? What happened? Next time, I think I'll angle my foot slightly differently, or I'll it was great, but there's a little bit more I could do, or just what was it like? Like, yay, I made it up the step, you know. So that's why we have the reading and the writing and the small group discussions and the buddies and the small groups. This is all method, if you will, to get towards in an educational view of this, just the learning outcomes. On the course website, you saw a short list. What you have in front of you is the long list. Yeah. And I'm not going to go into this in great detail right now, except to say a few things about it. But I'm going to give you a minute just to read it. And I already see one typo inside the circles, so I'll take care of that missing, that L got bumped over to the second line. I think they might have ended over there, so right next to you. And you might even see which ones, as you're reading through, get you a little excited or take your breath away or make you think, uh-oh, rut-row, what have I gotten myself into? Another minute. So the first section is the most Buddhist. So if you were at a Presbyterian chaplaincy training, perhaps the three of these categories would be the same, but it's the Buddhist one that's, I think, distinct for each of us as individuals as well as a collective. Yeah. I'm imagining there's some language in here that's not familiar with you, for you. There is some definitely spiritual care or ministry lexicon inside of this. So maybe we can popcorn out what some of these phrases are or words that you haven't really put together before, so we can just get an idea of what phrases and words here seem new to you for whatever reason. And I'm not going to turn around and say, why? You know, but just to popcorn, if you could grab a microphone. And how about if when you take the microphone, you also tell us your name so we can begin to learn besides staring at your name tag? So. Thank you.
Oh, I said I was going first because there's one that really puzzles and pleases me. Articulate their dharmology of care.
This is like within the pantheon of Dharma, which basket mm-hmm. is yours? Where like, what's your go-to Dharma? You know, and it's unique for everybody, if not similar too.
And I'm Kristen. I forgot to say my name.
Kristen, welcome. Who's next? Thanks, Conrad. Great. It's called psychic volunteering.
Oh, okay.
Just tell us which phrase speaks to you or piques
Conrad,
your curiosity.
Explain 3 to 5 Buddhist teachings relevant to spiritual care. Great. And I'm kind of curious, like, is it just suttas? Like, you have to know and be able to recite, like, the Majjhima Nikaya, like, stories from there? Or
start,
is it...
Start to finish, yeah.
Yeah, or is it more like, oh, this teacher had a story that really spoke to you and, like, is a reflection of...
It could be.
You know, practice.
It could be. It could be awakening. Yeah. What's awakening got to do with caring for people? Could be something really broad, yeah. So we'll see, yeah. We should just give this as a test at the end of the year. What do you think, guys? Answer these. Give an example for each. Thank you. You want to pass the microphone to somebody else?
Any volunteers?
Thank you.
Asia. And conclude spiritual care relationships.
Saying goodbye.
Conclude.
It's yeah. over. How do I transition from being, in some ways, a caregiver or a chaplain to you, to Dharma sisters? You know, like at the end of the year, for example, like I kind of make a formal statement at the end of the year, like, okay, I'm done teaching this course. So if I see you in the world, let's just be, you know, Dharma friends. Or if you want to be mentored by me, let's contract and be formal about that. But and what do you say when somebody says, can I have your phone number? I loved our connection and would like to talk about more about Buddhism with you. Like, do you? Don't you? Yeah. Great. Thank you. There's a song that goes with this from Kenny Loggins. I think it was The Gambler. You got no when to hold them, no when to fold them, no when to walk away, no when to run. So, like, how do you get in? And then how do you get out, too? Yeah. Sri, what jumps out at you?
Okay. Well, what jumped out at this, actually what Kristen asked before, articulate the dharmology of care, I had no clue what that meant. But anyway, you already answered that. So it said we'll talk about it, right? So the other thing is demonstrate a working knowledge of multiple religious beliefs. That mm-hmm. kind of jumped out. So because I honestly don't know too much about other religions. So I know a little bit, but not
right.
Enough to kind of right. provide proper context.
Right,
so,
yeah. right. And where you serve or volunteer, you will pretty quickly figure out what are the dominant religious or spiritual cultures. So, like, I worked at Kaiser in South San Francisco, so the staff and the clientele and the patients were primarily Filipino. You know, so then I had to learn about Filipino Roman Catholicism, as well as urban Filipino Roman Catholicism and rural Filipino Roman Catholicism, which are very different, particularly when it comes to making medical decisions. So it's that kind of, you know, or like, what are the churches in the area that people may be going to that I should just at least go by and say hello and go to one of their services, you know, or... You know, what are the holidays? What's that holiday? You know, and maybe go participate in it just in case someday, you never know, somebody. Somebody might say, I'm a pagan, and you might think, oh good, I'm glad I went to a solstice ceremony on the beach last winter on December 21st. Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Sure. One thing I want to point out is that there's both an inner and an outer around chaplain learning. I think we have a good emphasis in this training on the inner learning, you know, like, because you could imagine that as a chaplain, as a companion, you don't have a lot of tools besides yourself. Like, you are the one in some ways. And then, so to know who you are, you know, your strengths, your gifts, your shortcomings, your bad habits, you know, it's good to know those and then kind of intervene on them, you know, push some forward and hold some back, you know. Or to the extent that you know what it's like to go through a crisis and what your go-to is, then you can companion others through their crisis and kind of work the field between you. Does that make sense? Yeah, yeah. There'll be times this year when people have sometimes ask, well, what about when this happens? And what about when that happens? And as an educator, I usually sidestep that because it's a little too specific for the other people in the room, as well as who's to say, you know, you get 10 people together. But where the question comes from is an important thing to pay attention to. Yeah, I'll give you an example just for me. Like, so I was going down a flight of steps with a rail on the side, carpeted, in the morning, really happy, in Ohio with my family, and I slipped, and my whole weight, and I broke two bones. And the hardest part of this for me, aside from the massive pain when it happened, they say it's worse than childbirth. Oh my God. The biggest practice point for me has been being really mad at myself for doing it in the first place. Just like, Jennifer, how hard is it just to keep your feet on the stairs? Why didn't I drop the glass so I could catch myself? I kind of like fell and was still holding a glass. Like, you know, like just... there was a scene in Casablanca at the end of the opening restaurant bar scene where Humphrey Bogart's leaning on the piano and says to Louis Armstrong, the piano player, he says, of all the bars and all the cities and all the countries in the world, why did she have to walk into mine? This is like a famous line from Casablanca. And I was like, of all the steps, of all the days, of all the locations, you know, like, so, you know, that's my inner process around a crisis, you know, like that my own kind of lack of self-compassion is a pattern. It's not new. And I've had to really sit with it. And one of the most helpful things that somebody said to me was the doctor when I said, I can't believe I did this. You know, like, I couldn't even look at the x-ray. My husband looked at the x-ray and went, wow! And I was like, shh, I don't want that. You know, I'm like this. You know? And the doctor said to me, we all have accidents all the time. And once in a while, one of them is really serious. And this was like a little magic, spiritual care perspective. You know, this is somebody that sees this every day. And I thought, that's a really good point. You know, this is just one out of a million, you know, very consequential, but just one out of a million. So that's the kind of inner and outer that chaplains traverse. Yeah. And so part of really a big kind of thing to get used to, if you haven't cared for people a lot in the past, is that as the chaplain, gosh, I usually do this, I demonstrate this standing up, but I'm going to do it on one leg. I need a volunteer to help me. You want to help me, Gil, since you're nearby? So as the chaplain, metaphorically, if I'm the chaplain and you're the patient, right? Thank you. Chaplain, recipient, me, you, there's a space between us, the relationship, as well as the individuals. So as a chaplain, I'm tracking you, I'm tracking me, I'm tracking the space between us, And I'm tracking the context. Does that make sense? So you can see how these... Thank you, that's great. You can see how there's a lot to kind of take into consideration, and that's why I think these four circles are really helpful. Because, like, when is it me inside? When is it the space between? When is it them? When is it, like, the larger context? Yeah, so we'll work with that. And there's even a little diagram that'll be on the course website. I forget the title of it. I think that's the structure of a care relationship. Yeah, so that's something to really think about if you have that in your life already through your experience, and you may, in terms of raising children or being in a relationship or your role in your sangha, but it's really kind of the setting, the context, yeah, to really think about, take to heart. And as for an example, my husband, I'm amazed at how much it doesn't occur to him to care for other people. There may be innate care that you mentioned earlier, Paul, but I'm like, really? It just didn't occur to you to, like, you know, he's a software engineer. Like, you know, the little thing under the sink breaks, and he's all too happy to run around into the garage or the hardware store. You know, like, he's a fixer, you know. But he'll turn to me and say, wow, that was so nice that you offered them this, or you talked to them, or, you know, you're so generous. And I'm like, I guess some people are wired for this and other people aren't, you know. And so also in this training, you'll find out, like, how much am I wired? Or maybe in my life right now, only so far, you know, like, it just amazes me. It doesn't occur to him. I'm like, really? You just can't say to somebody, can I get you something when I get up? However, he's so even-keeled. He's such an engineer that, like, can you imagine what it's like to take care of me the last, you know, 4 weeks? He's completely nonplussed by it. People say, does your husband have a Dharma practice? I say, no, he doesn't need one. It's just even-keeled, but not like a caregiver. It's so interesting. So that's a little bit about kind of the learning, the pedagogy, hopefully by July you can look at this sheet and have a different understanding of it. You know, you can see, oh, I really got into this. I didn't get so much into that, you know. And that's a curiosity for us. Paula was saying, we learn too with you. You know, some of you may come to a mentor session and you're talking about identity, and I might want to take vows, or people are looking at me like a Buddhist, but I don't even know. And others of you are like, that's really clear, and, you know, I just didn't know what to do when this person asked me if God was punishing them for their crisis, in their crisis, you know, like, so those of you may be really focused on, I don't know whether to serve in prisons or in the streets, you know, like, what's the best use of my gifts, you know? So we'll support you with whichever one of these is really alive for you, and it could change. It could happen all at the same time. We'll see. Yeah, but it's, as I said to many of you in the interviews, we support all learning, and you tell us you'll figure out what really is the heart of it for you probably after the first few months. Does that make sense? Okay, great. A little bit on my story as a chaplain. I'm sure you're curious. And Gil and Paul each said a little bit about themselves and their practice. I trace the roots of what I call my ministry pretty much back to being a Girl Scout in the 70s, where I experienced community, a community of women, community of service, a community of learning, and I still have my sash, which is full of badges, you know. And a little while back, when I was studying the precepts and considering taking the Bodhisattva vow in the Zen tradition, I started thinking about the Girl Scouts, and the Girl Scouts actually have something they call the Girl Scout Promise. And that promise is to love and serve God, and to be a good to be a good person and serve your community. And I was like, wow, I was really young. I was 7 or 8 when I kind of started, you know. So that's how far back I kind of trace. How did I get here, you know? It's been a zigzag the whole way, don't get me wrong, but, you know, it goes that far back for me. And my mother tells a story about, I have a younger sister, that I actually helped toilet train my sister. So I guess I was doing service work from a very, very young age. Helping others, yes. Yeah. And I don't think my mom initiated that. I just think I was, you know, in some ways born to it. And for me, I didn't know much about chaplaincy, but when I heard the word, I got kind of really excited. And then not too much later, I entered a hospital that offered kind of a standardized chaplain education program. And I had no idea what I was getting into. Like, I cannonballed into the deep end of the pool and came up smiling, you know, like, wee, this is great, you know, and I've been at it ever since, you know. I'm very passionate about the work of chaplains. At this stage, I'm committed and fully engaged in the education of chaplains. So you as a group, this training, you as individuals are a jewel in my practice, in my life too. Like, this is my, you know, I'm going to be on my deathbed going, that was a really wonderful thing. That was one of the best things, besides finding practice and love and, you know, all the privilege I've had. Wow, that teaching that course was just a blast. So just know that I'm not here begrudgingly but I'm like almost over-enthusiastic, you'll see. And I'm from New Jersey. So if you've seen The Sopranos, those are my people. So I'm very bold and direct. I don't mind talking when somebody else is talking, but I've noticed here in California people do not like that. So most of the time I keep my mouth shut. I get into a little bit of trouble because I get aggressive or I'm powerful or I say things like in pretty straightforward fashion, you know, like when you're talking about our stance around diversity, Paul, you know, I thought to myself, yeah, and then there's the day I'm just going to say, as a chaplain, you got to be able to be offended. You know, like, so I can get a little reductionist and straightforward to just, and I state my opinions really, like, in a declarative fashion. But please know that from my heart, I welcome the same in you. And my bark is worse than my bite. Yeah, but I've just learned over the years to just tell people, like, you know, I come from such loud, bold, like, sassy, we swear like sailors, you know, like, just, so I was back with family when this happened, and they came in and told me that my ankle was, like, broken, you know, I was hoping it was a sprain or whatever, and I'm, like, lying in this thing with, I'm on, like, some sort of painkiller, I forget what, and the nurse practitioner comes in. And when he told me, I went like this. Up to the ceiling, you know. And I'd been having some conversations with my father for a few weeks, visiting him, about being a chaplain, about this training, about my path, you know, what am I renouncing around work at this stage in my life. So he was like, so who are you giving the finger to? You know, like, let's have a theological discussion about that moment. What was that, Jennifer? You know, and I said, I think that's the Jersey girl who's just like, you know, they're like, it's broken in two places. And so it's just a little, I'm a little, but, and I'm the most mellow one in my family too. And if you need verification on that, when you meet my husband someday, he can tell you, yeah, they're all a little brighter, a little louder than Jennifer. So, and in terms of practicing as a chaplain, what's really important to me and what I hope to bring to you and is hopefully of use to you is I know that it's a process to become a chaplain. It's not an event. So I commit to supporting you in your journey. Do you know what I mean? And wherever you go, yay! But it's a process of what's called discernment, often in ministry circles. You may not have heard this word before. And so now sometimes when I don't know what I want for dinner, my husband will say, are you in discernment about what you want for dinner? So he likes to joke me, because he's never heard this word till he showed up, you know, talking to me. So you're all in discernment in my mind, you know, maybe not in yours, you know. And it's an outer and inner, just like the care is outer and inner, the discernment, the learning is a dialectic between the two, which is why you really need each other in this training. You need your buddy, you need your small group. You need to come to the mentor interviews. You need to learn. Yeah. Yeah. And of all the chaplains I've known in different contexts, my experience personally is in healthcare. Is that one's own spiritual practice is the number one resource for doing the work. We each need an aquifer to fill the well that we can draw from. And the people I've known, or the times that I've struggled the most myself too, is when my spiritual practice was dim or low, or the volume was down. So sometimes when things get hairy, we think, I got to drop something, but it's actually, that's the number one thing. Like, and that's also why there's prerequisites for joining this training, that you each already have an aquifer to draw from in terms of the Dharma. You each already have quite a bit of what I would call spiritual formation that's already in the works, you know, and we're going to continue to cultivate that alongside you. Yeah. And we're not distinguishing between the Brahmaviharas and the Paramitas and the Eightfold Path and the, you know, like we're not teaching the foundational doctrine, if you will. Yeah. And the best chaplains, what was it? Let me think for a second. The best chaplains are the people who study themselves more than study other people. I would say, you know, like it's fascinating to think about what is the experience of those people in that kind of crisis. And I see this a lot in healthcare. People get really fascinated around, for example, end-of-life care and palliative care. Like it's fascinating, you know, like, you know, but actually studying the self, knowing yourself is the best way to become a good chaplain, is to really study yourself, more so than studying those people over there who are having trouble. You know, they'll always be there. They will always be there, you know. So when I first trained as a chaplain, I was in a Catholic hospital, and I couldn't even tell you that I was a Buddhist. And I had a yoga practice. I was ordained an interfaith minister that year. I had a new dog. I moved to San Francisco. And I thought the Roman Catholic Church was... I had an impression of the Roman Catholic Church that, as it turns out, was really inaccurate. And so I learned a lot that year, you know. So I wish you all the same in some form or another. And I think that's it as my introduction to the work of chaplains. Chaplains serve in lots of contexts, are not always called chaplains, but the competencies are what I really want to impress on you today, and what, a little bit what like the developmental path is like. Yeah. Because again, like I've said, I think most of you in the interview, you know, after this first class, you might think, oops, wrong room, wrong time, you know, I've got too much else going on, you know. And so we welcome your discernment even after today to think, you know, no, this is not the right place. So that's right. Again, we want to paint out for you kind of what's entailed so you can know with confidence that this is the right room and the right people for you. Yeah. which is what my life, like, what's my guiding star would be like. I'm always looking for the right room and the right people. I don't hardly care what we're doing together, but, you know, the right room and the right people is everything to me, you know, as a highly relational, highly socialized introvert. Yeah. Questions, comments, impressions? What's it like to hear me talk about this? What's it like to look at this sheet? Just shout a word and I'll shout it into the microphone, or I'll whisper it into the microphone.
Grounding.
Grounding. Refreshing.
Refreshing. Honest.
Honest. Boring? No? Okay.
Purposeful.
Purposeful?
Relatable.
Intimate.
Intimate. Daunting? A little daunting? Good. It's always daunting to go from the deck into the pool. At either end, the shallow or the deep. I'm about to be wet and weightless. It's a little daunting. Yep. I'm a big swimmer, by the way, so lots of water analogies and a water sign. Okay, so what else? One more word. What's it like to be together and look at this?
It's heartening.
Heartening. Cool. Great. Okay. And the last thing I'll say is, it's really nice to be teaching this to you again with Gil and Paul. My brothers in mischief. We entered this with reckless abandon, and now it's purposeful abandon, and it's a delight. Thanks, everybody.
So, have any of you ever been a recipient of chaplaincy care? Would you like to say a few words about what that was like for you? I wonder where the microphone is.
Yeah, I think this is a story which I think might have shared with Jennifer during the interview, but so the story goes back 10 years ago, where I was an avid biker. I used to, you know, bike with a nonprofit group for, you know, 100-mile bike rides and so on. So, I was feeling very good about myself. And this is July 2012, where I was mentoring a bunch of other bikers to do their 100-mile bike ride. So, got up on the top of this up to Skyline Boulevard, you know, riding all the way top up. Going up is always easy for me because I can't go fast anyway, right? So, coming down, I think I was a little bit not aware of my own body, how I was feeling, because we had just come back from a European trip and I was a little bit jet lagged. Coming down the Kings Mountain Road and full speed, like 25 miles per hour. And for a split second, I misjudged the turn. The next thing I know is I woke up in an ambulance, you know. So basically, they crashed. And luckily for my fortune, I was fortunate that my bikers sensed there was something really wrong, so they called emergency care, and I ended up in ICU for the next 3 days. And it's a long recovery, but When I was in the ICU, there was one gentleman who came, he came and just provided, I didn't know who he was, but he started talking to me, and more than anything else, he was present for me. So, and he said a few things about, in a very compassionate way, and I don't know what happened, but my all my things which were bottled up, emotions, just kind of floodgates opened. I started crying. And I couldn't control myself. And he said, okay, be compassionate to yourself. It's not your fault. Everything is, you know, the accident is not on purpose you did this, but it happened by accident. So he said something, few words here and there, but just gave me so much comfort. And it stuck with me for my rest of my life. I mean, I cannot imagine how relieved I was that day because, you know, I had all the guilty feelings that, okay, I did, you know, completely irrational, completely, you know, how could I be so unaware of the things? You know, I have two kids. I got to take care of it. Now I'm putting my family through a rough time. All the emotions came out. So, but he gave me, it's, you know, these things happen, just go with it, it'll be better. So, and that's when I think one of the motivations was, okay, if I could do something like what he did to me, that'll be wonderful for me. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Another hand over here. So was there someone else?
Well, I used to work with chaplains as a nurse, but then also when my father was dying and when my mom was sick, we had chaplains that were just wonderful. And I think because I already had experience with death and dying, it was maybe not as impactful or special for me, maybe. I mean, it was wonderful, but for my brother and sister, it was really, really great. And not so much the religious aspect of it, but helping all of us cope with, both of their illnesses were very, very different, but both were on hospice at the end. And my father was unconscious, so it was different, you know, but that was hard for my brother and sister to be with my father. Or they didn't, also parts of them thought there's no point in being with him because he's unconscious. But I think the chaplain really helped all of us with that and helped us spend time with him at the end and find meaning in that, and helped us a lot. And then with my mom, it was really helpful because she had been religious her whole life. Both of them were very religious. And then after my father died, she was really, really angry and not able to feel her feelings, and just was really pissed off that Dad had gone before her. And so she just rejected her whole faith and was really mad at God. And so the chaplain was really helpful with that. And we, a chaplain who was Catholic, because that's what she was. And he really helped her. And then I just want to say, when you mentioned, you know, they're not always called chaplains. And we had this amazing caregiver for my mom. Her name was Gracie, and she was very religious. In fact, she's just getting her master's in Christian counseling now. And, she was the fourth caregiver because my mom was a tough case. She chased the other ones away. But Gracie was just a saint, really, so patient. And she was literally her, you know, caregiver, like taking her to the bathroom and doing her bandages and wrapping her and living 24/7 in the house. And I know it wasn't easy because I know my mom, and I was there for a lot of it. So, but that, she really brought my mom. She was the one who really brought my mom back to her faith. And it was beautiful. You know, they prayed together and sang together.
Fantastic. if I remember the beginning, when your first words, you were a little bit diminishing your example compared to Sri. And it's true that his was exciting, bicycle, not many people, not that many people have accidents on bicycles and end up being, you know. So that was exciting. Yours was ordinary. It was like, you know, if you're lucky, you know, something, we're there, all of us are there when our mother are dying or our parents are dying. And it's like ordinary kind of thing. But it's ordinary, but so profound what it touches in us. And to have a chaplain show up at that kind of time, that sounded like very, very meaningful in this ordinary event. Thank you. So one more over here. I thought it was three people. Yes, Sage.
So I was able to work with the chaplain while I was at Stanford. I had been admitted there for like mental health related reasons, and I asked to see the chaplain because, you know, the nurses kept coming in and like trying to give me skills, and I'm like, you're missing the point. Like, this isn't about skills. Like, you have to like want to live to use the skills. And the chaplain came in and told her, like, I'm not like particularly religious. I just wanted to like talk to someone. And I just started talking to her about what I had been through and like how long I had been in treatment and how difficult it had been. She asked me about a spiritual practice, and I was like, no. Like, I had been Catholic way back in the day. But I had like been doing meditation for a long time. And she just talked me through it, like, yeah, kind of creating your own like reason for living that's like nested within spirituality. And like, we talked about like what kind of values that like an a la carte spirituality would have. And like, and she just sat there and prayed for me. And I think it was a transformative experience. I think it's one of the more important reasons why I'm here. Both here in this building and live. So just in case it wasn't clear.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I have a chaplaincy experience from this year. When my mom went into hospice, there was a hospice chaplain that came to see her. And then the hospice chaplain sat with me a little bit and said one thing that was really helpful for me. And right up until the time she died, this was a helpful thing she said. And it turns out that that chaplain went through this program. So it kind of came full circle, right? That we trained you, and you come and, you know, might care for us someday. So that's a kind of a... So it's a very profound, this world of chaplaincy, and it's a profound, the issues, the life and death issues, the existential issues, the connection between us issues are so rich and so deep and so meaningful. Jennifer talked about the necessity for chaplains having a deep aquifer, having a deep resource, some reference point that can hold all this and hold the crisis, the challenges, the depth of it all, not only for the chaplain's sake, but also for that's how people will know that you're a safe person to be with in their crisis, that you're comfortable, that you're open, that you're not, in a sense, not seeing it as a crisis. You're seeing it as one more place where you can demonstrate I don't have the adequate words, so you'll have to do better than me, but demonstrate an ease or a peacefulness or a certain kind of like willingness to be present without being anxious or angry or distressed or conceited around what's going on. And so people pick up the ease. They pick up this alternative way of being that sometimes no one else in their life has demonstrated. Everyone else has just demonstrated alarm and upset and angry, and you have to find someone to blame or shame or all kinds of things. But someone who shows a whole different way of being because they have that resource, they have that aquifer, they have that that the reference point for a certain way of being at peace, even if what is going on shouldn't be, even if what's going on is something that maybe even we should change, but still there's this peace that holds it in a bigger context. So what Jennifer talked about as an aquifer, I also sometimes also like to think of it as a capacity. Maybe the capacity of the aquifer can be really big. And one of the things we're doing in Buddhist practice is training ourselves, developing ourselves to increase our capacity for being with difficulty, increasing our capacity to be uncomfortable, so that even if it's very uncomfortable and difficult, that our capacity is so large that it doesn't trigger some of the unfortunate reactions of anger or greed or all the different kinds of conceit that can happen, shame that can happen, that somehow our capacity is to be with discomfort, and some of the discomfort is some of the greatest and biggest things that you might encounter in life. And the injustice that you might encounter in its role of a chaplain, it might be some of the most horrendous injustices. And maybe, if you're in the ER room, the injustice of what's there might not be what the chaplain is going to actively engage in, because that's not what's needed for the person who's laying there dying. So how does the chaplain have the capacity to see what's going on and hold it all in some bigger perspective and view to be of service and offer some new way of being, a new understanding, a new doorway into a fuller life, a more peaceful life, a resolved life, a life that somehow then maybe dies, if in the ER, dies with something resolved, something settled. And the issues, like, for example, of injustice, maybe that's not the name of the game at that moment. So how do we keep opening and opening and opening? And how do we hold it all? That's, you know, all the things that are uncomfortable, all the things maybe that shouldn't be. So it takes a lot. And I would like to think that Buddhist practice or spiritual practice is really, really important for this. There's now humanistic chaplains there's atheist chaplains. And so we don't have to limit ourselves exactly to Buddhism or to religion. There's other ways of developing this capacity that can hold it all. But this is a Buddhist training, so we use that as a reference point. So the question for you is, how do you see that your Buddhist practice or your spiritual practice, if you have another one that's maybe also important here, or your personal practice, whatever that is, maybe you don't call it spiritual even, but what are the practices that you have that are capacity building, that are aquifer building? What are the practices you have that will you see as supporting you in doing chaplaincy, that are supporting you to expand your capacity to be with the kind of range of things they're going to encounter potentially in chaplaincy? How do you replenish? How does Buddhist practice replenish the aquifer? Because it can be sometimes drained. So what's the role of Buddhist practice for you, and how do you see that it'll support you during this year? Do you have any thoughts about how to engage with it more during this year so that it augments, it supports, it kind of feeds this program? The other thing I think Jennifer talked about was the theory of adult learning as part of this. Adult learning is the theory, I think, is that you take responsibility for your learning. And so what responsibility do you have to bring your practice to bear in this? And that's for you to decide. But we're not here to tell you what it should be. But I thought it'd be nice for you to engage in a conversation about this. Did what I say clear enough and vague enough that you can find yourself, find a way forward with that kind of topic? Is that okay? I like it, questions that are specific and vague, so you feel free to find yourself in the discussion somehow. So I thought we'd just pair up and have that conversation with one other person. And maybe since you were you bunched up before with someone near you, maybe just walk across the room to find someone to pair up with. And then we'll take about 20 minutes for this as well. And maybe it can be like, it could either be, you can decide between the two of you. Do you spend 10 minutes each of you kind of talking about how it is for you, with the other person kind of being your support for that, as in questions for clarification or you know, so you're actively listening and maybe supporting the conversation, or decide whether it's more like back and forth. But if it's back and forth, be careful that everyone should be careful in a discussion that you have kind of more or less the equal amount of time. And so kind of don't say a lot all at once. Just make a few, one or two points, so the ping pong ball can, you know, can go over to the next person, the second one, and go back and forth more. I think then it builds the conversation. So you decide whether it's more a monologue or more a ping pong. Is that okay? So that's what you. So if you could just find a partner and go where you'd like. I saw that everyone went outside before. In the cabinet, just outside this big door here in the other hall, there's a folding chairs. And if you want to take those folding chairs outside, you're like in the parking lot, you're very welcome to take them out there. So please. So I would like to hear some comments about what it was like to have that discussion. Was any of it informative, inspiring, educational? Did it point to areas of growth? Yes, and so if you could use the mic, please.
I had a nice talk with my cohort. I thought it was very interesting in that we have a lot of cool things in common, things we've shared kind of on the path here, but have some interesting differences. For example, he had a really interesting practice of naming three things he's grateful for every day in the morning, and even doesn't have to be a big thing, even the small things, but I think that's little pearls like that, I think, that I learned, and I think I can put to use myself, so... One of the benefits of having these discussions is that it's always something to learn from the other people here.
Great, thank you.
I'm Clarence. Yeah, I let my... Well, my partner went first, and it was really interesting because I had something different that was coming to mind that fills my aquifer. And then when he shared, I was like, oh, that also fills my aquifer.
Yeah.
So we connected on that a lot, which was really nice. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. We're checking in about how the conversation went.
Okay, and something from our conversation that was interesting. There's the larger ways that we maybe tap into a deep aquifer or fill that aquifer for ourselves. And then there's like the smaller ways in the moment of just maybe reminding ourselves that like, oh, right, that is here. You know, those little moments of pausing or, touching into the body or whatever it is that are these like well-drilling moments that bring us back and remind us of that capacity.
Particularly useful on the spot doing chaplaincy. Well, I hope some of the things we managed to do this morning is to lay down the kind of foundational learning areas that you'll be engaged in during this year. Some of that which we hope that you'll engage in, you know, take some responsibility, really learn and develop, and that keep the chart that Jennifer gave you and refer back to it and see how this is going in these different areas and how you're learning. And that you have now from this beginning a clear sense of the importance of being connected to your Buddhist practice, because the interface of your Buddhist practice and this area of developing, becoming a chaplain or learning about chaplaincy, that's where it's going to be most rich in terms of what's called spiritual formation. That this is not just you're going to learn a few techniques, learn some information about chaplaincy, that you will be, you'll grow here, you'll be transformed to some degree during this year. I don't know if I call it leavening for that transformation is your Buddhist practice, or maybe that's the dough, and the chaplaincy is the leavening, or I don't know how it works, but they work together. The spiritual practice is a really important component of this inner growth, inner development that we hope you'll go through this year, and that you try to, both in terms of your practice of Buddhism, but if the teachings of Buddhism are important for you, that you're also reflecting on how they fit in or don't fit into the chaplaincy and what we're teaching here, and so that you inhabit the Buddhist teachings, Buddhist practice, Buddhists, even your practice community, if you have one, with some of the sensibilities and understandings and dispositions that we're developing here as in chaplaincy training. So to really bring them together. So we have a few more minutes, and
if you could take out a pencil and paper, or write on the paper I gave out earlier, or if you are like electronically, you can just open up a document too if you want to type. I thought we could do a little bit of writing to kind of let some of this content soak in. So I'm going to ask you give you some prompts for some reflective writing. And this writing will not be shown to anybody else. So your writing might include illegible handwriting or your native tongue or drawings or whatever kind of creative expression comes to you. But so given all that's come so far, if you could write for a few minutes to yourself and answer the question, what has touched me this morning? What has touched me? Or what has struck me? Or what has opened my heart? And you might include why something touched you or stood out to you or opened your heart. What is it about what has happened or what was said? Second question, if you're ready. One thing I'd like to remember or pay more attention to is. One thing I'd like to remember or pay attention to is. And why? One thing I'd like to remember or pay more attention to. And lastly, what's the question that if I had the answer would set me free? What's the one question that if I had the answer to, would set me free? Or make me happy? Or allow me to die in peace? But since we're Buddhists, we'll go with what question, if I had the answer to, would set me free? And then in a minute we'll bring this to a close. Pencils down. And then I'd like for you to imagine for a moment what would it be like to take what you've just written and show it to the person next to you? We're not going to do that, but just what arises for you at the thought of somebody else reading what you wrote? And also, imagine what it'd be like if the person next to you gave you their writing to read. What would that be like? The person next to you answered these questions and then wrote them down and then gives them to you to read. Yeah, what would that be like? And then even beyond that, imagine talking about what they wrote with them. What would you talk about, We're not going to do that right now, We don't want to strain any muscles this first morning, but the questions I asked you, one, are chaplain questions. And you're going to learn a lot of really good chaplain questions this year. So you might want to start a little index on, people always say, ask open-ended questions, but what is an open-ended question, Or what kind of questions prompt people into reflection as compared to sharing information? And so what you've done in this writing is what I would call reflective writing. And some of your writing assignments are going to be this kind of writing, reflective writing. And you're going to be giving your reflective writing to somebody else to read. Well, what's that going to be like, This kind of writing, And you'll be reading somebody else's reflective writing. So this is a little introduction, a little taste of kind of where we're going to get to around the learning through writing. And also how to, it'll open you up to what's happening for somebody else and then how to respond, And some of you are probably accustomed to writing about your thoughts and feelings and have maybe a journal practice, and others would probably rather scrub a sink than write about your thoughts and feelings. So between the two, we'll all place ourselves in varying spots over time. There's no wrong answers to any of the questions for today, and there's no, in the writing assignments and stuff that follows, it's not that there's something wrong. It's just how deep can I go and how clear can I be and what's it like to articulate it, even to myself, by seeing something in writing is really quite stunning. I noticed that in doing the box exercise when things I think about myself, but to just write it on a little piece of paper it just turns the volume up. So thank you for doing that little reflective writing exercise with me. We will be teaching you more about how to do this kind of writing if you're not familiar with it. So if this was a real stretch for you, don't panic. We're going to support you in cultivating that. Okay? Great. So thank you. And now we're going to hit the pause button for lunch. So there's a few ways we do lunch here. The aforementioned chairs in the cabinet, and then the other longer cabinet with a door open right now. One has chairs and one has tables, and we can bring the chairs and tables out to the driveway and sit and eat together, which is kind of nice. Or you might want to just, take off for an hour and be by yourself. That way is El Camino Real, a major street with eateries along it. I imagine you have a device to get you somewhere. There is a Whole Foods market about a mile and a half down the road. And I've noticed over the years that by like September, people are pretty shy the first day around food sharing, but like by November, it'll be like, who's going to Whole Foods in my car with me right now? And then there might be a Whole Foods carpool and pick me up a beverage, that kind of thing. Just enjoying some, you know, Sangha time together. When we come back, we're going to have a very dry and hopefully clear-cut journey through the components of the program. And then after that, we're going to spend some time doing an exercise on what it's like to meet another in a particular way. There are two microwaves in the kitchen. There are utensils and plates. It's a self-cleaning system. What did I forget? Anything? Master of the property.
Yeah, I think all of us feel some responsibility for caring for the building. So if near the end of the lunch break, if it looks like the kitchen has gotten a little bit untidy, if you're the one, you might want to consider just helping tidy it up some. And then if you want to go someplace with someone here or by yourself, that's like a little park bench kind of thing to sit on. If you go up two blocks up Hopkins, El Camino's that way, Hopkins is that way, there's a little triangular park, teeny one. It's kind of like where the traffic has to go around. So, but in that park, there's one or two benches. And you can sit under the oak tree there and kind of a little bit away from the drama of IMC. Yeah. So I hope you enjoy your lunch and
back in an hour.
Yeah. Anybody going to Whole Foods?
145. Back at 145.
Anybody going to Whole Foods for get food for lunch? Is everybody bringing their own lunch? Or is it okay? So.
Thanks, everybody.